Talofa lover, you're listening to Tangata o Te Moana from RNZ Pacific. I'm Susana Suisuiki. Coming up first.
We should have paid much more attention and we were not ever consulted.
Pacific leaders are told not to watch from the sidelines when it comes to geopolitical deals. Also,
this is a new generation. We all understand that we're moving forward and we forgive people. We don't hold grudges against each other.
The New Zealand government delivers on one of its promises to heal the hurts from the Dawn raids. And later on,
Maka, what have you done to my house?
Surprise, my man! We're going to show our pride to the world!
Tonga's passion, or mafana, is brought to the big screen. A former Secretary General of the Pacific Islands Forum says Pacific leaders need to sit up and pay closer attention to deals like AUKUS, the Indo-Pacific strategy, and China's response to them. Dame Meg Taylor says Pacific leaders are being sidelined in major geopolitical decisions and they need to start raising their voices for the sake of the region. The UK and Australia signed off on the AUKUS deal, where the Australian government will spend nearly 400 billion New Zealand dollars over the next 3 decades to buy a fleet of nuclear submarines. Kuroi Hawkins spoke with Dame Meg Taylor about the ramifications of the deal for Pacific countries.
Let's just go back a bit for the listeners in the Pacific, and good morning to you, my brothers and sisters across the region. The issue here is that we should have paid much more attention to the Indo-Pacific strategy as it emerged, and we were not ever consulted by the countries that are party to that, including some of our own members of the Pacific Island Forum. Then the emergence of AUKUS, Pacific countries were never consulted on this either. And with the Blue Pacific Partners, that's another grouping now, Australia with the United States and the UK, in terms of aid issues, they did not consult. So should we be concerned about what is happening now with Australia's purchase of submarines being to be constructed in Australia, but, you know, under the auspices of AUKUS? I think that the concern for us is that we in the Pacific, particularly those of us who are signatories to the Treaty of Rarotonga, has always been committed to the fact that we wanted a place to live where there was no proliferation of nuclear weapons. The debate, I think, that will emerge within the Pacific is, are nuclear submarines weapons? I have not thoroughly gone through the treaty in terms of some of, I think it's Article 3 that deals with this, whether the definition of nuclear subs not carrying weapons would still contravene the Treaty of Rarotonga.
And the Australian Prime Minister obviously has been at pains to try and talk about them not being able to breach this, but we have spoken with a few experts who say it is a duty for Pacific to hold them to account and not take that for face value. Would you agree with that point?
I would indeed. But the question here for me is, how are we going to monitor that? How are we going to know what if there are ever any nuclear weapons on these nuclear submarines? And the question for me, just as an ordinary citizen, well, if you've got nuclear submarines, what are you carrying? And I think a lot of people in the Pacific would ask that question, that do I define a nuclear submarine as a weapon? And if the government, whichever government is carrying these, that owns these submarines, says, well, we're not carrying nuclear warheads, then what's the purpose of the submarine? Now, it's been interesting, the debate in Australia over the last day, particularly the reasons for this. It's more about ensuring that their trade routes are protected. And all of you in the Pacific know what a busy sea lane we have across the Pacific and north-south as well, through my own home country, past our islands. We have very busy traffic with the trade routes going into Asia and to China, and that this is part of the protection of it. I think the Australian public will be very interested in discussing this, and I'm sure there will be people who are for this and people who are against it.
Yes. One of the other discussions around this is Australia and the AUKUS partners sort of talking themselves into a war with China, with the policy direction and the decision to go down this path?
I think the China is seen as an aggressor. And that it has taken an aggressive stance in Southeast Asia, particularly, you know, its declaration of over the South China Sea, and asserting sovereignty over that area. That has been, I think, a big red flag to countries like the United States and to Australia and to the Southeast Asian countries. But it's really interesting how ASEAN has come out very clearly that they will take a neutral position on all this. The Pacific Island Forum, I would urge that we are paying much greater attention to what is going on and not waiting for Australia to be briefing us. And I understand there were, well, this is what I read anyway, that there was about 60 telephone calls from Canberra to other parts of the Pacific to counterparts to inform them of the situation and what it meant. And we should be, I am appreciative of that. However, I think it would have really been helpful to have very in-depth discussions with the Pacific long before all this has happened.
The world's top scientists from the United Nations have released a new report, saying it's the final warning to act urgently on climate change. But Greenpeace says the report is repeating what the Pacific already knows, that the impacts on the region is now at a crisis level. Joining me is Shiva Goundan, the Pacific advisor to Greenpeace Australia/Pacific. Well, Shiva, first of all, can you go into a bit more detail about what this report is all about?
See, one thing that is extremely clear in this final IPCC report, the synthesis report, is that 1.5 degrees is still on the table. But we need to fight like our lives depended on it, just like the Pacific has done for decades. The path currently is very narrow now, and it has been lit by the most vulnerable, most marginalized communities, and the whole world needs to start walking this path of life.
Now, I understand you were in Vanuatu when Cyclones Judy and Kevin hit, and you were helping out with recovery efforts. Would you say that when it comes to climate change and the impacts it has on human rights, are Pacific people the most violated?
Look, we all know our Pacific people are extremely resilient. You know, the twin cyclones that hit Vanuatu, both were Category 4 and above. I think Kevin reached Category 5 with over 230 kilometers of wind. But after the cyclone, you could see the smiles on people's faces because they're trying to pick up whatever ruins that was left and to rebuild again. But this spirit of resilience is starting to become thinner and thinner, and there's this deeper hurt within our Pacific communities because of something that we have contributed the least. You know, the Pacific communities and the Pacific countries have contributed the least to climate change, yet they face the greatest consequences of climate issues across the world.
Now, what exactly is new in this report, particularly for the Pacific?
The previous reports have been very dire. One thing that is extremely important in this one is that there is still a little bit of hope. You know, I know they touch on the technology, etc., but one thing, like I said, is there's this hope of still being able to reach 1.5 degrees. There will be a period after 2030 when it will overshoot. That temporary period is called the overshoot period, but we can bring it down if we cut emissions extremely rapidly. You know, so no fossil fuel, no coal, oil and gas, no new coal, oil and gas projects. But if we are continuing in the current trajectory, we are not only going to go fractionally beyond 1.5, but go way beyond 2 degrees. And that will have extremely devastating impacts on the Pacific communities that are already, that can already see the impacts of climate change right now, especially the low-lying atolls. For example, Tuvalu, I was just there a few days ago, and you could see how sea level rise is deeply impacting the cultures, the identities, and the languages of these communities. They can't grow their own food because the ocean is seeping into the land. That means the salinated water is not allowing for any crops to be grown, and the land is then seeping into the ocean, which means it's devastating the marine biology of Tuvalu itself. And it's ironic, but it's very sad as well, because in the Pacific, we are deeply connected to two really important things which shape our identity, and that's the Wasa Wasa, or the Moana, which is our ocean or saltwater, or our Vanua or Fanua, which is our land. And currently, these two things are in conflict with each other, and it's a conflict that we have least contributed to. So the Pacific people, like I said previously, contribute the lowest in terms of emissions, global emissions, but are facing the greatest threat to their culture, their lives, their livelihoods, and the future of the survival. You know, so personally, there's new things in the report in terms of what countries can do. But the most important thing is that we need to phase out of all coal, oil and gas.
Yeah, I mean, it's so admirable that us as Pacific people, we have this great resilience and hope. But I mean, how many reports does it have to take for climate action to happen, given that there's already been 6 reports from the IPCC since 2018?
I've deeply thought about this, actually. We can't keep being briefed about these reports and not do anything about it. You know, we can't keep going to conferences to negotiate for our lives. The strongest action needs to be taken by the world, and there's no better time than now. The best time for climate action was 20 years ago, but the second best time is now. We have to stop filling the pockets of the very few, which is the fossil fuel order, and we need to start thinking about the lives that we are sacrificing when we are doing that. And these are not just hundreds of lives. These are millions of lives across the world and millions of lives of the most vulnerable and most marginalized communities. We need to stop the talk, and we need to stop just having these reports briefs, but and start going into strongest actions across the world so that climate justice can be realized for our Pacific family.
Well, now, what outcomes are you seeking from this final report? What tangible outcomes?
Look, the world can. Pacific Island nations have always shown leadership when it comes to fighting for climate justice, not just for our people, but people across the world who are facing all this climate impact. And there are a few tangible things that can be done to ensure that. And one is, like I said, to phase out of all fossil fuels, coal, oil and gas by 2030. Even before that, it's much more better. We need to stop all new coal, oil and gas projects that are being planned. And finally, the world can stand together hand in hand, shoulder to shoulder, with the Vanuatu government and thousands of civil society organizations, and also now co-sponsored by 117 other countries across the world, including Australia, to take the world's biggest problem of climate change to the world's highest court, which is the International Court of Justice. They are seeking an advisory opinion to make clear what states' responsibilities are when it comes to climate change and human rights. And these are not just human rights for our generation currently, but for future generations. There's this beautiful concept in Samoa where when a baby is born, the umbilical cord, which is called the whenua, the same word that we use for ancestral land, whenua, the umbilical cord of this baby is taken to the ancestral whenua, the ancestral land, and planted there. This is the first connection for that young child when it comes to what the ancestors stood for, what they paved for the future generations, and climate change is wiping out these lands and wiping out these opportunities. This advisory opinion is fighting for just that. It's to try and save our communities, save our cultures, save our traditional practices, our languages, and importantly, our whenua and our moana, so that the future generations can live a life of dignity and continue practicing this proudly.
Tonga's Prime Minister is pleased with the outcomes of the inaugural Conference of Pacific Education Ministers. This was hosted by New Zealand's Education Minister in Auckland this week. Lydia Lewis was at the conference.
Wakawa Meiliko Siosisovileni has met with Aotearoa's Education Minister Jan Tineti. He raised the issue of sky-high tertiary fees for Pacific students studying in Aotearoa and concerns over the RSE scheme.
Even teachers resigning and actually going on seasonal workers program. So we're looking at strengthening our training institution, getting more people enrolled so that we can cater for our local demand.
Ms. Tineti says Huakava Meiliku is not the only leader to have raised a similar issue with her. She says she is not ruling out changes being made to make it more affordable for Pacific students to study here, but says it would be a massive change.
I absolutely understand the issues that he's talking about. Let's see if we can find a way forward. I've had similar discussions with other ministers here as well, so this is something that we have discussed as a collective, and I've committed to everybody in this room that we will continue to have those conversations.
At the conference, an Education Ministers Network was established.
It's basically a communication platform whereby we can continue the discussion. There's a whole lot of issues in education that we need to discuss. Can't cover it in 2 or 3 days, but at least we've started it. We identify key issues, as the Minister of Education of New Zealand pointed out, but then we can continue that discussion rather than waiting for another ministerial meeting.
The ministers agreed that learning life skills is an important part of a child's development.
What we are doing in Fiji is we are trying to move away from only focusing on academic and exam-oriented classes. We are trying to put more emphasis on learning about life and soft skills in order to understand relationships and careers and be a well-rounded and successful person.
He says there is a real need to preserve Pacific Indigenous knowledge for a more resilient education. The role of women in education was raised by a number of leaders. Education Minister for the Solomon Islands, Linnell Olandria Tanaganda, says she wants to see more women at the table.
Being the only two females ministers of education in Pacific, thank you for the honour.
Ms. Tanaganda says there is a need for universal design for learning in regional and national policies and framework.
We already have our national priorities, and what can our development partners do to make this a reality? We request that it should not be done in silo, but in partnership. In Solomon Islands, the MFAT and DFAT is a leading example of this partnership, and what we request of them is to coordinate other supporting partners to join support for Solomon Islands and the Pacific.
For Kiribati,
we see education as an investment. Spending money in education is an investment. That's what we believe. We don't call it an expense, but we have to use it wisely. And that's why we need to come here to learn and work with our partners.
Alexander Teabo says more teachers are needed. Funding is also needed for its national university campus because at the moment, government scholarships for international study only cover students who get a certain grade, and those who do not meet the mark study in Kiribati.
That's why we ask the USP to help us with our campus, give us campus in Kiribati so that we can accommodate those students in our national campus in Kiribati.
Papua New Guinea's education minister wants Pacific nations, including New Zealand, to ramp up teacher and student exchanges. Jimmy Oguro says there have been such programs in the past, but they came to a halt during the pandemic.
Teachers from Papua New Guinea can come to New Zealand and Cook Islands and all the other places. So we share a culture and we are on the same page, same talk. Students can also do the same. We have such program in the past where teachers and students are exchanging programs, but now it's not happening because of the COVID-19 and the other challenges.
The host of the meeting, Jan Tanetti, says she would like to explore teacher and student exchange. She says she has heard the minister's concerns around the narrowing of school curriculums and agrees life skills are essential. Niue's education minister had high praises for New Zealand for prioritising an inclusive education for Pasifika students. Last year, the New Zealand government funded the Vangahau Niue language app, and progress was made to implement Ngangana Tokelau and Vangahau Niue into NZQA curricula. While the New Zealand Education Minister says it will be around 3 years until it is fully operational, Niue's Saune Tongatule is pleased with the progress.
Thank you, New Zealand, for leading the inclusion of Vangahau Niue and Ngangana Tokelau alongside Samoa, Tongan and other major languages taught. I think the role of women in education should be for discussion. We all know that women play a major role in education.
Jan Tanetti agrees more women are needed around the table, especially in education.
I'm very lucky in our parliament. We have 50% women representation in our parliament. It has changed how we talk about things. Women do bring a different perspective, and it is really important that we hear their voices, and we hear their voices loud. It's important that we have a balance. Support those women into those leadership roles to help be around this table as well.
The Secretary General of the Pacific Islands Forum spoke at the conference. Henry Puna said without education to drive economic growth, Pacific nations will remain dependent on others to finance development goals.
It's been 50 years since the infamous Dawn Raids, a rigorous enforcement carried out by the New Zealand police to search for overstayers, mainly targeting Pacific. The raids ended in 1979, but it wasn't until 2021 that the Pacific community received an official apology from the New Zealand government. Since then, the government has set up initiatives as part of their long-term reconciliation efforts of the Dawn Raids. Jan Kahoots has the story on one of those initiatives.
On the 1st of August 2021, former Prime Minister Jacinta Ardern announced that the New Zealand government would provide resources to teach Dawn Raids in schools and invest $1.3 million towards academic vocational scholarships for Pacific communities. This year, 28 young Pacific leaders from four Pacific nations have been chosen for He Manawatiti Scholarship Program 2023 to build knowledge and skills. The scholarship recipients hail from Fiji, Samoa, Tonga and Tuvalu. However, is this enough and could the New Zealand government do better? Successful applicants Laitia Fifita from Tonga says the New Zealand government has been doing its best.
I think the New Zealand government is doing already a huge amount of work in different aspects, in social, economic development, in so many diverse areas in our Pacific countries, and the aid, the funds that we received from the recent Hunga Tonga Hunga volcanic eruption.
Many of the recipients are already serving their own community and say that the scholarship program will help build on their knowledge and capabilities that will benefit their home country. Entrepreneur Tika Edmonds says she will implement what she learnt into her business in Suva, Fiji.
I am an entrepreneur back in Fiji. Yeah, I run a home-based business in Suva. And it's such an eye-opener because we are all leaders in our respective backgrounds and the line of work where we came from. Understanding this, it plays a big role into growing our knowledge and upskilling ourselves.
For some recipients, the Dawn Raid's apology was emotionally triggering, but it was a step into the right direction. Samoan recipient Teresa Henrietta Wolf reflects on what the Dawn Raids meant to her.
You know, us back in Samoa, we have that tradition of forgiving, our traditional ifonga, the way you apologize when you do something wrong. So, but you know, this is a new generation. We all understand that we're moving forward and we forgive people. We don't hold grudges against each other.
A film about die-hard Tongan rugby fans was released this week. Called Red, White and Bras, the comedy is set during the 2011 Rugby World Cup, inspired by a true story. It follows a group of Tongan fans who form a pre-game Bras band in a desperate attempt to get tickets. It's New Zealand Samoan director Damon Fepulia'i's first feature film. Damon spoke to RNZ Pacific's Whenau Whanua about what it took to make a heartwarming and uplifting tale.
So this movie, could you describe your inspiration for making it? How did you choose this story?
This one was, I was approached by a company called Picky Films and two of the producers there, Kafu Neal and Morgan Waru, who I'd worked with before, they had the script that was they were working on, and that was from Nua Whenau, who was the it's his story, based on his true life story. So they brought the idea to me, or pitched it to me, and said, "Oh, would you be interested in helping to write the film, just to get it in for to turn it into a script, and then to direct it as well." So that was kind of how I came on board at the beginning.
Is it true that this is your film debut?
So this is my first time feature film. So I've worked in television for probably about 25 years, just doing different things, documentaries, music videos, comedy, drama, all kinds of things. And I'd sort of been working on trying to, writing scripts for film, but this is the first one that I've ever actually got to direct. So, yeah, my first time directing a feature film.
And what's that like?
It's pretty surreal. It's kind of buzzy at the moment because it's we spent so long. Well, I guess the process of making it was quite long. We had probably had spent maybe a year, year and a half writing it and then getting ready and then filming it. And because the filming happened during COVID times, we had to stop filming and then start again. So the filming took ages, and then the post-production process happened. And then there was also, like, once we'd finished the film, there's sort of like a 9-month wait before it actually has come out. So it was all like this massive journey. And then now we're waiting for the film, you know, the film coming out on the 23rd of March. And it's just like, now it's like the exciting kind of time. So yeah, after all the waiting, we're finally getting it out. So I think, you know, just because it's my first time feature film, that yeah, it's pretty exciting.
I was watching the Oscars a few days ago. I don't know if you're watching, but
I saw highlights, but not the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, to be honest, I didn't watch the whole thing right off. but you had the first Asian actress win an Oscar. Mm-hmm. Do you foresee yourself there in a few years?
I don't know, to be honest. I'm not sure. I mean, if I did, it would be a long way away. But I mean, I guess it's, I guess because with the Oscars, it's one of those things where I think people kind of sometimes get a little bit like, you know, it's just Hollywood, just people who are kind of congratulating themselves. But then actually when you see those speeches, especially like for those actors who those Asian actors and how important it is to see them succeed, it's like, oh yeah, man, you know, it's like it is a great aspirational thing to just be like, oh yeah, I think, you know, one day I could, you know, I could, that sort of thing could happen to me. I don't know if it'll happen to me, but it's like at least it's you know, it's something to aspire to. So yeah, I'm not sure about that, but I think for me, it's just like, oh, I just enjoy making things that, for me, it's kind of about making things that I hope that people will enjoy. Like, you know, making films that, like, I think, especially for this film, is like something that, it's a film that anyone can go see and enjoy. Like, it's not like, I guess not even the sort of film that would potentially even win at the Oscars. But at the same time, it's one that I think, you know, people could go to, like, you could take the kids to go see it, or you could take aunties and grandparents to go see it as well. So yeah, I think for me that's the main thing, is just that, you know, making the films that everyone can enjoy.
As a Pacifica director, there are not many out there. Could you describe why you think that is?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, because I think that's changing, which is good. And there's sort of a few of us Pacific directors who have been around for a while, but there's a lot of, I think, hopefully there's a lot coming through. Like, I think, especially in the last few years, I've been on a lot of projects where it's just like, you can see that next generation of talent coming through. And I think part of, like, with this film, and I think with a lot of the other projects that are coming through, it's kind of more about Pacific people being the ones to tell the Pacific stories. So whereas I think the cases for a long time, the cases a lot of the time has just been non-Pacific directors or producers or writers making these, telling Pacific stories. So I feel like there's sort of, you know, that change is happening, and there will be the young people who are making things, who are starting now, will, you know, in 5-10 years, there'll be like a lot more Pacific directors coming through. And I think that's across the board. It's kind of like, oh, there's a lot more, you know, there's more of a movement for like female directors as well. And like people have, yeah, just more diversity really coming through, and the people that are directing, and the people who are kind of in charge of telling the stories.
That's Tangata o Te Moana for today. Remember, you can download us for free to your device from Spotify, iHeart or Apple Podcast. And if you're using Apple, please leave us a rating so others can also find us. Whakitai te le lava, so far soi fua.